What is happening? Welcome to another episode of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock on this pitching podcast, and I have a special guest today. You might have heard him on The Athletic talking about playoff baseball for the past couple of weeks. It is Eno Saris. Eno, so great to have you part of this show. Good to see you.
I've missed you.
Yeah, I missed you so much, man. It's been
Where
like
have you been?
Weeks. I have been, last week I went to surprise my mom for her 70th birthday.
Woo!
So I did that. And then the first week I didn't have my ADHD medication and I was a wreck.
Oh, no.
I was an absolute wreck for an entire week. And I was supposed to get my top 200 out. I was going to do a podcast with you. And
you just worked. Completely were not.
And just, I tried so hard and got so far, but in the end, it just did not matter. But good news, you know, I have a top 200 list. I have been watching playoff baseball. And we're going to save that top 200 conversation for another time because we have some amazing playoff baseball to talk about and some pitchers in particular. And you've been doing some great work over at The Athletic, doing this amazing podcast every morning. Tell everybody about all the stuff that you've been doing.
Well, just that on Rates and Barrels, we've been going daily during the playoffs.
Yeah.
And, you know, we actually had, you know, early on a little bit of a situation we were like trying to recap every game and preview every game.
Right.
And we just realized like we're not that type of podcast. And also we record in the morning Pacific time. You know, if we're going to be recapping and previewing games, that we just affect the shelf life of that podcast too much.
Oh man, let me tell you, I do the plus pitch and first pitch podcast. I mean,
yeah,
I get that. Yeah.
So we changed our setup a little bit to where it's a little bit more like our normal shows. We're using things that are happening. And I think we can, you know, bring some of that same energy today, which is that we're using things that are happening to talk about larger things so that,
right,
you know, it's not like a preview of the game that's coming out, happening tonight.
Right.
'Cause that's just, those things don't live very long. And
no.
I've seen the numbers also on in terms of writing, like, writing a preview that people care about is very difficult.
Yes.
You know, we actually tried a lot of different formats at The Athletic, and you know, it's pretty difficult.
Yeah. We had our staff did such a great job with our playoff previews in the past, and we would do it for every single series. And we would get these amazing graphics done by our team, with Justin Paradis at the helm, of combining two teams against each other. They were so good. But they just wouldn't be read. And it's just one of those things of when it comes to the playoffs, it's just people just kind of consume it. And that's it. Maybe they'll talk about it in some way, but actually doing written work on it isn't quite the way to go.
I wonder if like some part of it is the fact that, you know, a large portion of readership is reading because they care about fantasy or DFS or whatever.
Yeah.
And that readership falls away during the playoffs. Mm-hmm. But then I also think that the way we consume sports changes a little in the playoffs, you know?
Yeah. It's a lot more fast paced. It's a lot more.
We're also just not as interested, I think, in the analysis.
Sure. 'Cause like anything can happen.
Yeah.
Right?
That's probably why. Yeah.
So yeah. It's a great point.
You're not as interested in the analysis as much as you are. I think the things that do well are like stories of, you know, how we got here, you know, more like general, like sort of narrative type stuff, because we're trying to make sense of the chaos during the playoffs. And it just helps if you can be like, oh, this all started on a playground in Hoboken and 2010 when Mark Vientos like stepped to the plate and then hit his first little league home run.
Oh man. I know this is a pitching podcast. I just have to say there are times when I watch a batter and I go, oh, cool, that guy's going to be a star.
Yeah.
And
you feel
the way that Vientos takes his pitches and actually swings the right ones and everything. From what I've seen, and also our Process Plus statistic is showcasing that Vientos is going after breaking balls instead of fastballs because he was worse at them. So then he flipped. He essentially said, I'm going to be looking breaking stuff instead of heaters. And trusting that he'll get better at heaters. And now we're seeing the playoffs that he's getting better at heaters again.
That's fun. I think that when you start to see an adjustment like that, that's when I start to believe in Bratter. It's because, you know, not only has he made an adjustment, makes him better, but it means that he can make him again.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. He's not just like one of those guys that I know you've certainly talked to players like, hey, cool. So have you looked at other guys? What are the adjustments you're making? And it's just like, I don't know. I'm just kind of doing the thing that I've done for ages. Right. And when you see a kid coming up that has obviously the talent, but then understands that there is still so much more of the craft to learn, speaking, hey, that's our podcast. Well, it's a really great fun.
Against Landon Knack, where he was fouling off the breaking balls.
Yeah. He wasn't
I thought he was looking heater and fouling off the breaking balls. Where do you think that places in what you saw?
So there's a feeling as a hitter. I mean, I'm not going to say this is what every hitter does, but generally it's, I will not be beat by this is really the idea. Not that you're going to put it necessarily in play, is that you feel more confident in one versus the other. And the way that Vientos was fouling those off was essentially saying, yeah, I'm not necessarily on this 100%, but I'm enough in on it that I can not be beat on it, which means that eventually he'll get the fastball, which I obviously was more comfortable with.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I took away from that was that we talk a lot about adding an extra pitch as a way to go deeper into games and to soften the third time through order penalty and show people different looks. But when you have a long AB like that, and the hitter has not swung and missed and has spoiled everything, and then, you know, you go back to the fastball and it's middle. Like, I know your curveball and your change are not as good as those other two pitches, but that would have been a real great time, I think, to drop in a called strike curveball. I mean,
right. Exactly. You got to give something, just something else to like break the pattern, essentially, you know, in the rhythm of
really interested to see what like Strider does when he comes back.
You will never
think he'll have a sinker. I bet you'll have a sinker. And
well, that's one of the biggest revelations I've had this year is, I mean, really with a lot of discussions with you is multiple fastballs for strikes.
Yeah.
At any point. And it's why I'm not going to lie to you. You know, if a pitcher gets traded from the team that he is on, I'm trying to hide the guy. If Garrett Crochet gets traded from the White Sox to a competitive team, I think he might be my SP number one. I know that sounds absolutely bonkers, but I see someone who I undervalued because I didn't realize the combination of velocity and extension that he had. And I wasn't really ready to properly analyze that one, which essentially means that he's like, they're going 7.5 extension with 97. So what that means is that if you want to hit that four seamer, which he gets in the zone all the time, you got to cheat on it, which is why the cutter is so good, because they can't tell the difference. And now he's throwing the sinker too. And I think he had like a boatload of super high swing straight rate.
I almost missed
on
that. He's throwing a sinker at the end of the season.
Right. So yeah, now he has three, and you have to.
I don't think he has to leave. Honestly, that's my take. It's just.
Oh yeah.
I think Brian Bannister is pretty good, and
what's more about wins.
Some of the focus this year was on, you know, kind of transitioning from being a reliever to being a starter, and just being like, okay, I'm going to dominate four innings or five innings now instead of one.
Four innings, unfortunately, because no one got to win. Yeah.
So, I do think that leaving the White Sox will help him get wins. So.
Yeah, well, right. That's what I think is the big separator at the top of it. But I don't know. I
thought you meant in terms of pitching coaching.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Oh,
no,
you meant more wins.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I misunderstood. Yeah. That's something that I forget about sometimes when I'm drafting.
Oh, certainly I do too. Yeah. I just the guy. I just want like the idea of the guy in like a little orb that floats.
Like, I'm definitely gonna have some Sean Burke shares next year, and I'm.
Oh, you know, but that's so. Oh, that's
people
so
are gonna say something about wins, and I'll be like, oh, right, yeah, wins. Well, hopefully, get some.
I mean, the thing, my argument about it is that yes. Like, the extremes are more likely or unlikely, right? Like, the extreme of him having a 15 win season is down, and then of course having five wins is increased, right? But it doesn't mean that a double digit win season is out of the question. That's a third of the starts that they make. They have a higher chance of winning. I see the overall team has a bad winning percentage, but if it were five Garrett Crochets, that would be a much higher winning team. So think about on the times that he starts how successful it is. Guys still get wins even if they're on.
Yeah, Fetty had was 7-4 in 21 starts. You know,
right?
He could have broken double digits.
Yeah, it's possible. Don't write it out. Anyway, the whole point of this is multiple fastballs. Big deal.
I bet you. I bet you. When Strider comes back, he's throwing a two seamer, and he's cool with the curve again. But
yeah,
you know, one thing is like, does he blame the elbow injury on the curve? That'll be one thing he's.
I don't see why he needs a curve.
I
don't know.
I think something slower.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very much of the thought pattern now of just like slider for a break. If you don't have a good changeup that you trust, that's fine. If you want like a show me 5% to 10% curveball, sure. But really, I mean, I've been banging the drum on this with Dylan Cease for ages of a cutter. You know, a cutter, if you're going to be that over the top, more gyro slider kind of guy with a good ride four seamer, you're made for a cutter. Don't go the full slider, just a little bit that takes some velocity off of it, gets a little bit extra movement, and now it's just harder to discern which of these two it is.
Yeah, I would love to give him a something that wiggled, two seamer maybe.
Yeah, Cease. I mean, yeah, all that.
But if he doesn't control the four seamer, would he control the two seamer any better?
I mean, he controls the four seamer good enough, Strider, no?
No, I'm talking Cease.
Oh, Cease. Great point. My counterpoint is Kodai Senga. He commands
his cutter better than his four seamer.
Yeah, and it's a scatter plot of four seamers. And I remember being so perplexed by Senga because that four seamer has a lot of the metrics that you want to see on a four seamer, right? Good attack angle and pretty low delivery, and velocity is over 95, and his swing strike rate would be sub 10%. And I go, what is going on? Oh, you're not really locating it well. Oh, they are jumping on this and then giving up on the cutter, and the cutter is absurdly effective for Kodai Senga, except it wasn't the other day against the Dodgers. As we bring it back to the, this is a segue, but we can certainly stay here, Kodai Senga just failing to spot anything. I mean, that was...
Well, I saw, you know, not to blow you up, but I saw you have him in your top 30, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And I'm gonna have a hard time ranking Kodai Senga because he did not show us that he was healthy. I don't think you know the first start back he threw 94.5 or something, and that was his third slowest fastball velocity of any start. Yeah. And then he comes back out and he throws the slowest fastball of any start. It was like 92.3. In that start, that second start of the playoffs. In the first start in the playoffs, his cutter had arm side movement.
What?
He only threw two of them. He did not have his cutter. In that two inning like thing where he pitched pretty well,
yeah,
he did not throw his cutter because it was going arm side.
Yeah, and Senga without the cutter is just not it.
Right. So, you know, two innings, I think that was a little bit of a false bounce where you're like, oh, he's throwing 95. I mean, it's his third worst velocity, but it's not bad. And then you did like the fork is still there, but then the cutter was not there. And then he comes back out and he throws 92. It's like, yeah, he's going to have a full off season. It's going to be one of those things where I think he creeps up in the rankings if he's pitching in the spring and he has okay velo numbers, you know?
Yeah, so you're talking about the bounce, by the way. We have a phrase for that. It's called a Dennis. It shows up, but doesn't stay around for long after Dennis from 30 Rock.
That's much better. I have a new kitty in the house. It's much better than the other one.
I know. That's why I needed a different phrase than that. Which
is it the Dennis? He shows up for a little bit, and then he's not.
Yeah, Dennis. He shows up for an episode, but doesn't stay around for a while.
Right. I like that.
Right. So with Kodai, I actually, I put that ranking in the first week of October or so, and I didn't really take that into account. I think that's a great point. I'm probably going to lower him now for that. I do want to mention that I remember being spooked by Shane Bieber coming back before 2022. And he had about two games and it was lower velocity and just wasn't himself. And then he went off and had a phenomenal 200 strikeout season the next year. And the other side of it, we see like McKenzie throwing bad stuff last year and then not being good by the time, you know, arrived this year. So
I just feel a little bit better if I see them, if they come back 100%. And they give me two or three starts and
But yeah, Senga, I mean, also the really diminished velocity too, and trying to do everything for his team, but he's not ready yet is just, oh no. And this was a Tommy John scare, correct? And then he healed it. He healed his elbow and then came
calf
back.
Calf and shoulder.
Oh, it was shoulder the first time, not an elbow.
Calf and shoulder.
Okay. That's a very good distinction.
Which could be worse.
Because it's fair. Yeah, it's so funny. We used to think, oh no, shoulder as the bad one. But now I'm like, oh, shoulder's fine.
Yeah. I mean, there have been more guys that have, you know, taken a month off a shoulder and been back and been fine. But that always, I have this tickle in me that I'm like, ooh, shoulder. Shoulder used to be a career ender. I think now, I think now when you go down for shoulder, it's like preventative more, you know?
Right. It's just like, it's like inflammation. It's just like, oh, you're sore. Let's just not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't pitch with a barking shoulder. Oh, in any case, I mean, I think, you know, drafting him, I think a lot, and this is something where I think this might help us segue a little bit, is I think generally the pitchers who are pitching in the postseason are making it harder for us to rank them next year, are actually muddying the water and making it harder for us to analyze them for a couple of reasons. One is, they're naturally going to throw harder in the postseason.
100%. Yeah. Then it's Kodai.
You know, Rates of Barrels listeners heard this, but you might not have. So I was talking to a hitting coach, and he was like, oh, I saw your thing about the postseason velo bump. And I was like, yeah. And he goes, oh, that's because every team just lines up all their pitchers and they all get injections of Toradol before the playoffs. And I was like, but okay, this is a hitting coach, you know.
Yeah, right.
He's just mad about the pitching or whatever. I checked around and there was enough, like, I don't know about that characterization. Like, they all just line up and do it. Mm-hmm. Maybe on their team, you know, there was a little bit of that, but there was not there was not a refutation of the idea.
Oh my God.
And so Toradol is not a steroid. It's a it's an anti-inflammatory. It's like the most powerful anti-inflammatory that you can get.
Is it banned?
And so the way I was described is, you feel amazing because the inflammation's gone. But
is it banned?
Huh?
Is it banned?
No, it's not banned.
Oh, so it's totally fine that they're allowed to do this.
It's fine,
but it puts you more injury risk.
It does add to injury risk because you can just basically be masking inflammation. Like, your body is making the inflammation, but you have the Toradol, so it cleans it up. And, you know, but why is the body making the inflammation? There's something not right.
Right. So, it's how these guys go on like 3 days of rest or whatever. It's why we feel pain, everyone. We're supposed to know that there's something wrong.
They're all throwing harder, you know, almost all of them.
Oh, man.
And so we see them, and then the last bit that makes it even worse is that they keep getting taken out so super early. So we're like, we don't even know what they might have done if he'd been given five innings. You know, like, we're ooh, you know, is Cole back? Like, is Garrett Cole back? I don't know, because we saw like a fairly decent. He was getting better as the season was going on, but the command was not back this year.
No,
and then in his last start, the velo was there, and the velo has been getting froggier and froggier as, you know, as the season's gone on and into the postseason. But the command was not there. And in fact, he should have maybe been taken out of that game earlier than he was taken out.
Yeah. Did you say froggier?
Yeah.
Like leaping?
I'm feeling froggy.
Oh, I don't know this phrase.
You never heard this? I've heard of it.
No.
It's like, you're just feeling good. Like, you're throwing hard.
Oh, I love this.
I don't know where it comes from.
I mean, that's just great. You're just like, yeah, I'm a frog.
Maybe your fastball's jumping. I don't know.
Yeah. I had a friend who was obsessed with frogs, and they sent me like pictureless logos with frogs. Not even kidding. Like,
it's like AI making a pictureless logo with a frog in it.
It's like a pitcher with a hat and everything. It's like pitcherless, and it's a frog, you know? I have like a collection of them. So yeah, feeling froggy. Dig this. This is great.
Dude, what you need is, you need a recurring, article that's about like velo being up, and it's called like Feeling Froggy, and you've got all the logos for it.
The AI generated picture list. Oh God. I'll send
make
them.
Make me managing editor. I got
I'll put some of them. I'll tell Adam to stick some of them into the podcast thing. I have a couple of these images. I'll just throw them in here. But about Cole specifically, his slider just hasn't been the same. I mean, it really has just been gone since he's returned from injury. And you would say, oh, Nick, that's sticky stuff. It's not, because it was there last year.
Yeah.
The slider returned and it was fine. And, you know, I don't want to say like, oh, he found a way around the sticky stuff.
That's why he's throwing his cutter more, right?
Yeah. But even in this game, it was 17 combined sliders and cutters, and the knuckle curve was thrown more, 19 of them, with 42 four seamers. It's strange. It's not the classic Cole. What I appreciate so much about Gerrit Cole is actually what he did, similar to DeGrom, is saying, look, I have the slider that I can throw down in glove side to both handedness, and I'm just going to always do that, and good luck.
So it's slider command that's missing, because I'm looking at movement and it's nothing leaves off the page for me.
Yeah. So it's even in this game, he had a couple that I can recall that he actually executed right, but it's just, Cole doesn't even have the same faith in this pitch. And there was, I think, maybe one or two games in September, I said, oh, okay, there might be that slider again. But yeah, I'm a little scared. There is, of course, a feeling that Gerrit Cole never really was fully healthy. He certainly needed a moment to come back into it, and he was performing well. But I watched a lot of this and thought, what am I kidding? I watched the whole thing. It's a Yankee playoff game. And I thought there were some really great pitches and great locations with the four seamer, some really good curveballs down. But I didn't get that feeling of just domination that we get from Gerrit Cole. And I really implore everybody to ask your subconscious, if you can, while you watch pitchers, to get a sense of your own confidence in them in that moment, right? You can read body language, whether you focus on it or not. You can read if they're going to put it in the right place, if they're going to get this guy. You just know these things. Watching Cade Smith against Austin Wells, I mean, come on. We all knew that guy was going to strike out in the three pitches from Cade Smith. Bam, bam, bam. You knew this, and it happened, right? And I remember like watching Zach Wheeler in the spring. It's just like, you watch Zach Wheeler start, and it's like, yeah, he just is going to do it, and who cares? Mm. And watching Gerrit Cole, there were times he had it, but it's not what I used to see from Gerrit Cole, of just, you think it's going to be this, here's a slider, and you're just going to wave over that. We literally have our CSW award called the King Cole after Gerrit Cole, because it was just so dominant. CSW, if you're the number one in CSW in the majors, that means you are arguably the most dominant, because you just get effortless strikes consistently. And he's not that anymore.
It is weird, because my unconscious was like, what was I debating? I was like, hey, why is he still in here?
Yeah, right.
In the fifth inning against two lefties, and Naylor hit him hard. Why is he still in here? It's the third time through the order. I don't know if I, in the past, would have been yelling about third time through the order with Cole. I've been like, yeah, it's Gerrit Cole. Right. You let him go. He's doing fine.
21% CSW yesterday for Gerrit Cole. And we're talking like routine
17% strikeout rate in the postseason.
Oof. It's weird.
It's strange.
And yet, you know, the Yankees might win the World Series by default.
Oh, I'm not saying the sky's falling.
Oh, I know. But
I am saying, like, you know, he would be wild. Somebody that he is somebody that I've made my number one pitcher, you know, many years. You
right.
Know? And it's always tempting to put him in there. And I'm looking at you and you got him 12, and I can't argue with you, you know?
Right. But I mean, to bring it all back to the playoff question, we're going to talk about the pitchers in particular and just kind of what it means maybe for the next series and World Series. We're going to talk about all that after this break. So just to bring up that point quickly, it's kind of wild. I never felt this way when it comes to the ALCS and the NLCS, of just no team is just saying, yes, we're the favorites. Like, it's just, we're obviously, you look at some paper, we are the best team. Now, it should have been the Dodgers. And the fact that the Dodgers are where they are without a full rotation on the IL is unreal. We all we said is all they need is for their pitchers to be healthy in October, and they're not. And yet they're still making it happen. The Yankees obviously have their flaws. There are many holes inside the lineup. We're talking about Gerrit Cole, their ace stud, is not the guy of old. You see the Mets, that their rotation is working.
Yeah, so weird.
It's really unreal. I do
the pitching previews for The Athletic for each series, and I'm like, I've been constantly being like, you know, these guys have a better staff than the Mets. Oh, well. Okay, these guys have a better staff than the Mets. Okay.
I mean, right? Manaea throwing cross body now, lower arm angle. David Peterson, I guess, having good control now, command-ish. He didn't really in that Dodgers game. The fastballs were not that, but Quintana kind of making it work. Severino, maybe? It's oof. And then you have the Guardian.
Next Severino start would be really hard for him because they have some good lefty hitters and they have patient lefty hitters. And
right.
You know, nothing that Severino has really added. He's added a sweeper. He's added a sinker. These things aren't going to help him against lefty.
Exactly. That's always a weird thing with Severino. It was also strange about Severino is you've heard me talk on this about a four-seamer sweeper arm not being a good combination like Nick Pivetta. Because it's a major difference generally if you want to get on top of the four-seamer.
Yeah, even Bryce Miller said, the reason my sweeper is better this year is because I added a sinker. And so I sometimes just go sinker-sweeper on the hitters that are not good horizontally.
Yeah.
I'm usually Bryce Miller up here.
Right.
But on some guys, I want to be able to be like, nope, this could go either way this way.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Now, I wonder if Severino is doing something like that, but
yeah,
it's still not going to help him too much against lefties.
Well, Severino doesn't have, I mean, he is more over the top than your like Brady Singer types, but he isn't as extreme, I think, as say Pivetta, which might help him a little bit more with that sweeper. I was really surprised to see that the sweeper was the thing that he was doing, but right. It's still not ideal against a lefty. You don't have that. Sometimes he has that rare cutter that, oh, I still dream of that one game in 2022 when he came back or whatever against the Jays and he had like three different types of sliders and it was so good and then just disappeared. It was really nice. He had like a 93 and an 89 and an 86 and then, but yeah, all the rotations are weird. And then you have the Guardians too. Tanner Bibee was their ace, got bounced early, who, by the way, you mentioned barking shoulder before. Hi. He even mentioned that he's had a barking shoulder the entire year.
Bibee did?
Yeah.
Oh, I missed that.
And then Gavin Williams is there and Matt Boyd and Joey Cantillo, but Joey Cantillo is being used in long relief. I mean, we actually saw him just for an inning. It's just so strange. And I mean, yeah, I just feel like it's the Yankees to lose at this point. Am I wrong at this? Or is it, are they your favorites right now?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whew, oh, man. I haven't felt this way in a long time, you know.
I feel like, but Bibee, you know, for a shoulder that's barking, started the season 94, middle of the season 94, end of the season 95.
Yeah, it's wild, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know what your take is on Bibee exactly. I still am trying to figure mine out.
Yeah, I mean the sort of, you know, back of the napkin quick one is just excellent slider, just enough velo to make the fastball work. It reminds me a little bit of Bieber. I always distrusted Bieber because I didn't think his fastball was good enough, but
sure.
It turns out maybe his slider is good enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to distrust Bibee in the same way. You know, I don't want to make that mistake again. And, you know, just look overall at a 25-year-old at a 26% strikeout rate and a 6% walk rate. Like sometimes you have to look past the stuff numbers, especially when you got 315 innings.
Yeah.
That's not nothing at this point. So he's done well in the postseason too, other than the last start wasn't great, but it's a Yankee team. And, you know, I think he would have been allowed, this is what I'm talking about. This kind of clouding our judgment a little bit is I think he would have been allowed to suffer through that little part of the second inning.
Absolutely.
In a regular season game. And I think he could have maybe wiggled his way out of it and ended up with, you know, four or five innings, two or three runs. And it wouldn't have been his best start of the year, but it wouldn't have been, oh my God, your ace just got four outs at game two of the ALCS.
Yep.
Like, you guess your ace isn't an ace, you know? And then we have in the back of our head, the next time we take Tanner Bibee, we're like, is he an ace? Oh God. The last time I saw him, the Yankees were, you know, knocking him out.
Yeah, right, right, right.
But you have to kind of, I like what you're doing with you know, ranking the pitchers now because you're kind of being of the moment. And there's like these competing forces. One is like the recency bias of what's happening now and of the season we just had. And then there's almost an analysis bias that'll happen. Or like a hype bias where we're like, you'll discover something and be like, oh, this or that, or, oh, look, this guy had a this. It was, oh, it's like the 10th best slider of the year or something. You know, oh, look at this. And if only, oh, his command was actually getting a little better at the end of the year. And then we're like, I declare that Sean Burke is one of the best sleepers of the year.
Oh, God.
And everyone's like, Sean Burke. You know, said Sean Burke.
Yeah, right.
Then and then you yourself, you're like, well, I like Sean Burke. I like him better than Luis Severino, don't I? And all of a sudden, Sean Burke is like your 45th ranked pitcher going into the season. You're like, get. And then you see one start of him, and you're like, he's never going to win a game. Why did I have him 45th?
Hey, what's up? Why are you here, DL Hall and AJ Puck? Get out of here. Move on. It's actually, there's a really good quote for that exactly, which is, if you torture numbers enough, they'll say what you want them to say.
Yeah, right.
And I think about that a lot, especially when it comes to the offseason, where there's also graying of the space between 12 and 15 teamers. And I'm Why's very that? Much, because you have a lot of the volume guys getting more preferential treatment.
In the offseason? Teamers.
Yes. I think also,
especially if you're doing like, and there's the people who are drafting ADP now are drafting too. 15 teams, and they're doing draft and holds, and they want innings.
Right. Volume gets pushed up so much more as the offseason goes on. I hear all the arguments for it, for this, and then you can't risk that. You got to get the wins. You have to get the total strikeouts, all of these things. And in the past, it has forced me to raise guys higher than I'd like, just because, I mean, some ways I get exhausted and I just don't want to be able to say, I don't know, I don't agree. And I'm like, all right, fine, I'll get a little bit, but I try as much as I can, especially in this early rank, to be like, I don't have a reference. I don't have anyone else suggesting otherwise at the moment. This is how I feel after this. These are my reasons for it. And I think every year I try to get a little bit more stringent on it, or like more stern about like, no, I refuse to take Framber Valdez or Logan Webb. I'm sorry. I won't do it. No, I can't. And
Severino's like an off-brand version of them, where he's like, yeah, at this point I might get innings, but I don't know. I'm excited about
it. There's a whole thought also about if you have a 122 whip or something at the end of the year across 180 innings, that hurts. That is bad for a 12 team. It is bringing you down.
Oh, that's interesting.
And for a larger volume, that bringing down, that weight is
makes
larger.
It worse.
Yeah. So And it's really just emphasizing that I put out my table of, at least it's inside this article, so I'll put out at some point. It's coming, guys. I promise. I do it every year. Pitchers after ADP 276, which is essentially after your 12-teamer draft. These are theoretical free agents. Mm-hmm. And you have so many studs. It's like Tanner Houckin, Garrett Crochet, Paul Skeens, Jack Flaherty. I mean, you can make Jared Jones. You can make a whole team out of this. Mm. You know, Luis Heel. These are just off the top.
Yeah, I do an article every year that's 300 plus, and there's I always hit like, you know, two or three guys. You know,
right. And
Kyle Bradish was my big one that one year.
Nice. I was so out, and then all of a sudden he changed things and he stopped doing the bad stuff and did more good things. I was like, oh, well, never mind then.
He was doing that already.
No, he wasn't. No, he wasn't, you know. We talked about it. Okay. To bring this bring us all back home. So with Bybee specifically, what's so strange about him to me is, you're right, the four-seamer, it gets away with it. He like shouldn't be good. It's pretty mediocre across the board. I would say his command of it is better than average, but it's not one of those like, oh man, he just puts it where he wants kind of pitches. And the changeup and slider just bother me. The slider is good. He doesn't have an approach I can identify of, this is where he's going to put it. He's going to put it over here.
Maybe it's on purpose. He's trying to
put it over here.
You know, like I've seen a lot of this. Oh, this is interesting. And we talked about this today on Race and Barrels. The Guardians lead the league in, well, not lead, I think they might be second or third, but they're among the league leaders in high changeups and high changeups, sliders, and curves, and right on right changeups. So their approach in general is to throw it everywhere.
Yeah.
So you know who they should, if you're looking at his heat maps, you might be like, why is he throwing that slider there? He's probably throwing some high sliders on purpose because he's trying to be like, you can't just keyhole me with the high fastball. It's going to be a high slider up there sometimes.
Okay. So that's interesting.
I think you can't just be like, it's bad command. I think on some level he's trying to throw those.
That's interesting. I mean, I'm trying to think of the guys that who would be in that sample, right? So it's Gavin Williams. I guess some Matthew Boyd in there.
Eli Morgan throws high changeups. He threw some in this. Hunter Gaddis threw a high changeup the other day.
Yeah. I'm not totally convinced. However, if this is actually their thing, they should go out and sign Lucas Giolito. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's right. He's the high changeup king.
Right? I mean, he's a free agent, I think. I believe he would be.
But is he back this year or is this the year he misses?
He missed this year.
He missed last year?
This yeah, he didn't pitch a single game. It was March or so that he...
So he'll be back sometime in 25.
Yeah. But I don't know. I wonder if it's just, hey, try and throw it over the middle of the plate kind of approach. Just like, whatever, we're not going to be so specific. I just throw it in the zone. And it's hard for me to lean into that when you don't have a good fastball. Like Shane Bieber was not that. Shane Bieber, he spotted those things. He knew what he was doing with that cutter inside to lefties and the slider away. Like he did that like clockwork.
Bibby had a negative pitch value on his fastball this year.
Yeah, it does not surprise me.
But
I mean, pitch value is a results-based one for you guys curious about how it does with all of our
stuff. That's like adding up all the called balls, strikes, balls, play, everything.
And output. It also does weight situation too.
Oh, it does?
Oh, God, it bothered me. This is part of the impetus of PLV to me was it's the same fastball, but one allowed a grand slam, one was a strikeout, and it's the same, you know, like a single tier.
And they count the grand slam as opposed to a homer even?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just the run differential. It was like the, how many, this was more runs than the other one.
It was the one thing in Vibey's favor though, only 28% sliders. That doesn't sound like an only in past tense, but now that could go up to 35, 40 even.
Sure. Yeah. Actually we have a question from Zach here. I was going to segue into this, as well, but Tanner Bibee versus Gavin Williams. I think that's going to be a conversation for a bit. We haven't really seen Gavin Williams get comfortable this year. He was stunted by his arm injury earlier this season that they said wasn't much, and then it turned into months. And he never quite got his footing. How do you feel about Gavin versus Tanner?
Yeah, Gavin had this really strange thing happening with his fastball where... you know, for a while he was like losing ride and adding horizontal movement and becoming kind of two seamery. But by the end of the season, he got his ride back mostly. And he was also throwing 97s out there regularly, 96, 97. He had a start against the Dodgers where he averaged 98. So I like his velo and I like his curveball. Being clouded by the postseason, does his team like him as
yeah,
much?
Right?
He hasn't even pitched in the postseason.
No.
So, I'll take Bibee over Gavin Williams, but there might be a difference in price where, you know.
So I have them closely ranked. It's always hard. I'm probably going to have a little bit larger of a gap.
You're going to be low on Bibee at 43.
Oh, I know I will. It's just my gut.
You have them right next to each other right now.
I always do. Because I don't really... It's favoring, I think, safety versus a ceiling. Because I do think that Gavin Williams has the better ceiling just because he has a better fastball.
Yeah.
I've called him the right-handed Garrett Crochet because he throws 96-plus with elite extension. And that means, okay, start throwing a cutter and he's starting to do it. And... if that becomes two strike pitches between his four seamer and his cutter, like that's really good. And he's had this curveball that at times becomes an overwhelming pitch at the bottom of the zone too.
I just don't understand it when somebody has one, like a good curveball and not a good slider. Like, does not make sense to me.
That's actually what I was. oh yeah, I was much more comfortable throwing a curveball because I mean, it's different. It's different action. It's different coming off the ball. One is going forward with your index finger. One is going off the side with the index finger. And right. So the curveball, you're going over the top of it, north south.
Wrist with the curveball, and maybe not so much with the slider.
I guess. I mean, so throwing like a fastball is what you would do with a curve, and then you tilt it sideways. So then you're kind of casting it. Uh-huh. They're always taught with pop the gun. So you have it on your middle finger with the seam, and then you come out with your, you know, with your index finger. Uh-huh. But you're coming down through it. And for me, it was a lot easier to feel the seams with that and come through it and come down. While with a slider, the traditional way you're taught it is just you can go around the side of the ball and you throw just like a fastball. That's your tight wrist one. Mm. Then you have the throw it like a pizza, which is ridiculous. And it's white. Every parent says you'll throw out your arm throwing breaking balls.
I don't think that's how everyone throws their sweeper. Maybe
yeah, no. that was unbelievable. But I have seen actually like people talk about going around it like this. And it's every time that's so scary to me. To me, you're supposed to just come over the top on it. It does mean, of course, your arm action. If you
but
come out your
back
arm
and do
like
the curveball, and that looks a little bit like being around on it.
So this, right. But it's still coming forward. It's still this. Right. What's hard about this is that when you release with your fingers, are you getting enough side action on it? Mm. Or is it just going over the top and then just kind of cement mixes?
That or a cutter. Yeah.
Right. So a cutter for me was that I didn't really throw it much. You just tilt it over and you just get a little bit more on the side of it. I've also seen a cutter, which I don't really think is done much anymore, about making the ball not 50-50. But actually making it like 60-40.
Oh, wow.
Which something that I remember hearing when I was younger, and I actually one of my coaches called it a slip pitch, but I think that was really like this, but it doesn't matter. I always thought he was ridiculous. And it was a basketball coach, not a baseball coach.
there's your problem.
Yeah, right. He's talking about playing stickball in the 40s. Oh, Ira Runstein, you were amazing. I miss you. Essentially the idea of it was that you were not getting fully behind it. Mm. It was that you were forced to come on the side of it. You're supposed to fall off of it. The other way was without any seams, was actually making sure you fall off without them so that you are not behind it fully. That as you release, you're sliding off. And that means you're getting it that way because of it, because you don't have the support of the right seam. Mm. So curveballs for me, it just felt more tactile. It felt like I could influence it more and I can really understand it.
There's also some part of this that comes from your pronating and your supinating, like what you're doing.
Pronating and supinating, yeah.
So I was talking to Luke Weaver, and you know, one of the things that happens is, you know, pronating is for me is like sort of coming down this way. So towards your index finger, and supinating is sort of, you're coming down that way.
Mm-hmm.
And if you watch slow-mo video, even on a curveball where, you know, you're kind of, you think you're coming in like this, at the end, you turn it over.
Yeah.
You know, that's actually where a lot of the spin comes from, is like you hold it tight like this, but your hand always pronates at the end.
Yeah.
And so when I talked to Weaver, I was like, so when you say you're a pronator, what does that mean? We all pronate, right? And he said that when he comes through, so he has a one seam changeup.
Oh, the one seams. Yes. So that's a seam shifted weight changeup, like, essentially,
you
right?
Kind of put your middle finger.
So it's a circle change grip that is in the two seam or the four seam shape. You actually put it in the one seam in between.
Yeah. Oh, the one seam's in between. Once he's in between, because this finger captures this seam.
Yeah, right.
This finger captures this seam. And he said this finger is just for support, and it slips off. And then this finger sort of captures the seam. In any case, he was modeling that for me.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, yeah, we all come through and pronate at the end. He said, I'm pronating.
Yeah, early beforehand.
I'm pronating. Like,
and this is why people like to call it a scroogey. Because it's because a scroogey a screwball
is like sort
right?
of
right. I describe it as you got to do the walk like an Egyptian.
Yeah.
So you're throwing a curveball completely like this, as opposed to like this, you know, like so the normal way, you're just pointing the other direction.
But he said the difference between the pronator and supinator is just like, it's the point at which you pronate.
Yeah, so that's a great point.
He's kind of coming through. It's already coming out. And he can't throw a curveball. He has been. It's never been good. And I just wrote a piece on Weaver, and I had a thing with him where he was talking to Adam Wainwright about how to throw a curveball.
Yeah.
And Adam Wainwright, who, you know, famously does not care for the machines and does not care for that, those doohickeys. Oh,
that's how he got the color commentary job.
Yeah. That's the first thing they asked.
And he's doing great.
Yeah. Do you know what a rap soda is? No. So anyway, Adam Wainwright was saying, finish out in front. And I think, finish out in front is the idea is you've got this curveball, you've got this stiff wrist, you've got the ball, you're trying to keep it tight between this and this, and you're kind of coming through like this. And when you're coming through like this, or like this, I guess.
Right.
When you're coming through like this, the reason that you want to finish out in front is you want to keep it like this as long as possible so that when you do pronate, spin it a ton, right?
Right.
So imagine if you're trying to throw a curveball and you're already pronating.
Yeah, right. It's just not going to work. You're getting around the ball.
And you wouldn't throw a good one. And even if Adam Wainwright told you a million times to finish out in front, your body's just like, no, I'm pronating.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I think the Yankees have excellent pitching coaching, by the way.
Definitely.
And they basically told him, don't worry about that curveball. And he's not.
I mean, look at that.
Basically stopped throwing it. And they found a cutter that's good enough. They got more spin efficiency out of his four seam with just a, you know what he has is he has one of these fingers where this finger is like an inch longer than the other one.
Oh, right. Yeah. Well, I've got a little bit of it, but
yeah, his is even worse. This is his.
Yeah.
But so he was trying to hold the four seam and he was focusing on having the index finger on the seams because his second finger is so long, it was off the seam. And they were like, you know what? You just need to tilt this ball. And I know it's not how you like think, you know, a four seam should be. You just need to tilt this ball so both fingers are on the seams. And his spin efficiency went up because he's ripping the seams more.
Oh, that's so great. I mean, you've seen how Marcus Stroman grips the ball too. Like you can imagine.
His grips are crazy.
It's insane. But I mean, his fingers are also unreal.
Looks like he has fingers on top of finger. It's so weird.
it's like slightly crooked here and there too. Yeah. The way
like one will be straight and one will be crooked. Yeah. You're like, how are you doing that?
By the way, Luke Weaver. I mean, let's just be honest. Of all the pitchers that you've talked about, you want to go bowling with Luke Weaver the most, don't you?
I do. He's such a nice guy.
I love him. We interviewed him on our. Alex Fast and I interviewed him on Talking Pitching during COVID, and he was just the coolest. We just wanted to hang out with him, man. Like, it was great. And last thing about that with Adam Wainwright, when it comes to like, for me, what really was the
he threw a great curveball and didn't throw a great slider, so he's kind of in your discussion.
Was so comfortable for me. I had the mentality of get out as far as I can and karate chop my left ankle. That was what I'm doing. So pinky had to come down and open hand almost down.
Mm.
And I needed to do that as far as I could. So I had to make sure I'm trying to come under. I'm trying to end it like, with my palm up by the ground.
You're throwing the pizza.
Suppose of this. Not across my body. I'm just saying as I do my follow through and I have my mic in the way.
I get it.
Is I'm coming through like that, you know?
Yeah.
In that way. But that mentality, that's a huge part of pitching too, is just the small adjustments that you get just by visualizing. I mean, just the idea of I'm going to throw it to the left or to the right. You don't know actually how your body is shifting as you throw the ball to that, but you have to have the image.
Feel versus real.
Right. Exactly. So you're not saying, cool, I'm going to slightly do it by 0.05 degrees this way, and throw it, right? It's just, you do it. So if you have the idea in your head, hey, look, as you release this curveball, ensure that you also karate chop, you're thinking fastball until the ball is by your shoulder. And then you just karate chop out as far as you can toward your ankle. And that's pretty much how I threw mine. But for slider, I didn't have that kind of focused. So I didn't have that mind
cue or whatever.
You did. Yeah, cue. That's the word. Yeah.
For Felix, he's throwing the knuckle curve, which we try to have a fastball cue as much as possible. Mm-hmm. But Clark Schmidt said, you know, put it in your seatbelt in the end.
Oh yeah, yeah. Putting the seatbelt right to that's to the hip then.
Yeah. So yeah. I tell him stiff wrist. Most of the time I tell him throw it as hard as you can because he has a hard time sometimes getting it all the way across the plate.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a longer distance for him now.
And, right.
You know. So most of the time I'm saying, you know, most of these break. Almost all of your curveballs break. So don't worry so much about the break and worry some more about velo and getting across the plate.
Just pushing off and striding as far as you can. Turning that back foot and pushing as much as you can.
But
there is one more pitcher we definitely need to talk about because we were talking about before the show and we had to start it. And we're going to talk about him, Carlos Rodon, after this break.
I just wanted to talk about Carlos Rodon because... you know, I thought I was seeing something play out where, you know, I am not actually against the old school full tilt or anything. I a lot of times, you know, our research has come back around and found a lot of the stuff that the old school knew was true. But it took us a little while to get there. And I do like measurements and I do like data. So like, you know, want what I believe to be supported by those things. So,
right.
But you know, so what we saw was Carlos Rodon in his first outing against the Royals is screaming. I mean, he's got the open chest, like, you know, the no undershirt, just sweaty screaming.
Nick Cassiano book.
Yeah. He's going crazy out there. And to the point where Michael Garcia like retweeted something of like some clip of him screaming, saying, "Oh, I guess you were celebrating too early because they got to him." You know, he had this terrible fourth inning against the Royals where I looked at it, 8 of 13 of the pitches were of his fastballs were in the waist area.
Yeah,
and that caused him to have to go slider in the zone, and when he became really kind of 50-50 fastball that I don't have to worry about or slider in the middle of the zone. I think people started sitting slider. You saw Sal Perez homer on a slider. You saw singles off of sliders that were on the black on the bottom that normally would have been effective pitches that were made less effective by the fact that his fastball was nowhere near and you didn't have to honor it.
Man.
And so, you know, he's screaming. So then Chris Kirschner at The Athletic has this great piece where he talks to Andy Pettit and he talks to Carlos Rodon. Apparently Pettit sat down with Rodon and talked about intensity and playoffs and like how to corral that intensity. And what you see is Rodon is sitting 97-1 against the Royals with his screaming. And that's the second best velocity of the year. And then against the Guardians, he comes out, he's 95-8. Which is pretty much right in the middle of what he did this year. And he's looking great and he's commanding it better. And he gets through that fourth inning. And I think he does another inning on top of that. And so, you know, in my head, I'm like, oh God, is what the old school is saying is true? We had Whit Merrifield saying everyone's out here throwing as hard as they can. And they don't have command anymore. That's why this guy hit me in the head. And we just saw Rodon dial it down and find command. Is that what happened? So I just thought I'd do something really quickly. Where I went through his starts this year, and I looked through his 10 best starts by velo. He had a 96.2 fastball velocity in those. And I looked at the 10 worst. He had a 94.7. So that's pretty different, you know. Those are different. So he had a 120 fastball stuff plus when he was throwing harder, and a 106 when he wasn't. So that makes sense. So then I look all the way over to location plus. He had a 97 location plus in the 10 starts he threw the hardest. And he had a 97 location plus in the 10 starts that he threw the softest. And I think, you know, that's another way that these playoffs are going to lie to you. Is there's so much intensity on what you're watching. And there's so many people feeding you narrative that you're going to believe these things. And... you know, you're going to forget that same energy you had all season where you bring data to it, or you think about, you look at the whole sport, or you look at a bunch of pictures, or you look at somebody's piece where they did a bunch of research on it, you just remember John Smoltz saying, well, he came back out in this game and, you know, he's not throwing his heart. I don't, it wasn't John Smoltz, but you know what I mean? Like, you're going to remember what the announcer is saying, and
we all believe
like, oh yeah, maybe pitchers are throwing too hard and that's causing them to lose their velo. I mean, to lose their command. On the other hand, we know that if you're throwing at the very top end of your velo, it's probably not as much command as if you're not throwing at the very top end of your command. Like, that's a,
right.
That's a truism, right? So I don't know exactly how to square those two things. I thought I'd value your perspective as a former pitcher. And just what you think of that. I mean, we know that if people are missing by a lot anyway, maybe they should just throw as hard as they can. That, I think that's the idea.
Right. So it's hard because I actually can't locate if I'm not going at least 90%.
That's another thing I've heard, that you can't ask DeGrom to throw at 85%.
Like, it doesn't work like that because it's your timing. What do I slow down?
Yeah.
What do I do? Do I slow down my arm? But then I won't be as accurate. You know, you've practiced at a certain thing. There's something about that of like, what do you practice at? And because if you're practicing at 100%, then you will probably be a little bit more accurate at that. It's not about the velocity itself inherently. That is the reason that it's wild, is because you're overexerting to be something that you're not used to with timing. Right. The surprise thing I had for you, by the way, is that we updated our today's fastball app.
Oh, nice.
We have a new version that Peel Pro people can access that has all pitch types and has our own first iteration. First, it's not done, of our own PLV Stuff Plus inside of it. So it's not the Fan 4 Plus. It's like a proper Stuff Plus version of PLV. And looking at the game against the Royals, so October 7th versus October 14th, Carlos Rodon's overall Stuff Plus was 116, 117 against the Royals and 115 against the Guardians. So the slider and changeup were better against the Guardians. I mean, even just looking at, also paired with that, this is not location-based, but paired with it, I also see, his command of his changeup and slider on both sides of the plate, much better. Four seamers are more dominant up top. Stuff Plus on the four seamer was about 100 for us against the Guardians, 107.
So many in that fewer Royals waste game. Pitches.
Right. And and you're not wrong that I think you, I shouldn't say it like that. You're correct. I think him going 97, adrenaline messes with things. This is why we talk about MLB debuts. Being like, you can't trust this because they are going to be, it's going to be a different emotion, a different feeling all the way through. And they're going to be less consistent because of that. You talked to Andy Pettit. I'm glad. I mean, Pettit obviously has ice in his veins. You just give one look at him behind the glove and it's like, oh boy, I don't want to go near you. And I hope that got through to Rodon. It does seem to me that he had a much better feel of the slider and changeup though. That really
mixed his pitches more. I mean, that's another thing. Like, he was fastball slider only against the Guardians, and maybe that was the game plan. But, you know, against the Guardians, he threw all four of his pitches in that fourth inning, at least.
Yeah. Right. And that against the Royals, too, we were saying, I think all four of his hits were off of sliders. Mm-hmm. Three of them were pretty meaty down the middle. And
which is his best pitch, but...
Well, he threw two changeups that were whiffs in that. And then, as you mentioned, too, 8 over 13 fastballs right out of the zone. So he had to throw a slider is what they were thinking. And that's really that's also the biggest element that I can't emphasize enough about pitching analysis is Rodon was killing it for three innings. The extra energy and everything was great. And then it just wasn't. And somehow the mix of it messed them up in the fourth. Either it was some fatigue or it was... couldn't keep it up, and he didn't know what to do, didn't adjust. I don't know, but it was one inning of it.
As hard as that, but also threw some curveballs and changeups instead of the waste fastballs, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, right. And my question is, like, so why is he throwing those waste fastballs? What is the impetus for that? Because that's really the crux of the entire inning is that, oh, cool, you don't have your fastball. Let's not aim for the fastball now. We can sit on other things.
Yeah.
And they crushed him on that, right? And that's why they swung twice the changeups out of the zone below. Because they were, you know, like, oh man, this is a low fastball. Then okay, cool. Nope, never mind. So that's it's the hardest thing I think we do is sometimes these like blow up games that we talk about, oh, he's so prone to and everything. It's like literally three innings the entire year that change an ERA by 0.5 points or something.
You know, and it when you talk about relievers, like you know it in your bones when you talk about relievers.
Absolutely. So how do we weight that? Is it a consistent thing of they are more prone to collapsing, or is it just this happened to them three times among a massive sample and that it seems like noise? Yeah. Right. So you know, Carlos Rodon, you're just throw those changeups and sliders. You're good. Please. No more waste.
To see where you got him.
Rodon, I have like in the, my second Holly tier. So it's like Sonny Gray, Justin Steele, Jeffrey Springs at the end of that. And I still don't know how I feel about it. But I feel like Carlos Rodon's fine and it's a winning team.
40.
Yeah.
Yeah, he always projects really nicely because his stuff is so high. So my projections always say he's going to be great. One thing that also stands out to me is he has a 0% walk rate in this playoffs.
And, is that right?
And you're like, yeah, but that does not mean he has had a great command.
No, I know. I'm thinking more about the blow-up innings that he had. I would have thought he would have had
Yeah,
a walk
there was
in
no
there.
Walks in there. It was just they just knew not to have to touch his fastball at all. He seems to me almost like a patron saint of a cherry bomb. Not that in more on like the seasonal level than the game log level. I mean, I'm seeing a 6-run game, an 8-run game, or a 7-run game. So he's kind of a cherry bomb.
That was the first half of Rodon this year was just menacing.
Yeah.
And then he's finally settled down around the All-Star break or so.
But
the
even after the All-Star game, he had a 5 and a 4
Yeah, you're right.
After the All-Star game.
Yeah, but Matt Blake had a quote saying, yep, we're doing one thing and we got to change it up. And then like the next game, he threw 24% fastballs. And then all of a sudden, it was rewritten. You know, it was just
wonder
like, all right,
the
guys,
one thing you're changing.
Yeah. And cool. But that's a really important point because then they just don't know what they're going to get in a given night and they need to establish that, right?
The thing is, he's your kind of, I think, your epitome of a high stuff, low command guy. And it doesn't show up in the walk rates necessarily and even his home run rates, but I think it shows up in the year-to-year volatility. I mean, the 6.85 ERA his first year in New York, you know. He had a 5 ERA before he got injured in Chicago. But it also shows up in sort of game-to-game with these blow-ups, and I think he just makes it very hard to bet on him. What if he takes what happened in that Guardians game, throws another time, maybe they're in the World Series, he has a good game in the World Series, you know, he's gonna float up rankings and we're gonna forget that game against the Royals and we're gonna forget those 7s and 8s he hung on us in the beginning of last season,
so
but they're still gonna be there because he does not have good command.
It's interesting. So I think like when I consider what I call a cherry bomb now is your Dylan Cease, your Yu Darvish, your Taj Bradley.
He's like Dylan Cease. You know? I think he's very much like a lefty Dylan Cease.
Right. So my understanding of Rodon, I think is more, there's a clearer narrative, at least for me, of someone who generally does throw his four seamer where he wants to, which is he's trying to go upper half all the time. He generally has that slider that goes down. He does that. And then I like the adaptation of the changeup appearing, really, because it is a lefty changeup league. And I could see that getting better. I see this also, the stretch in 2023 of getting hurt and trying to prove his worth as a contract. And it didn't go well. Came back with all this added pressure. Is he okay? Is he not? And then it clicking and being more of that guy. I mean... A lot of my rankings, I know it sounds crazy. I mean, every ranking has to have some sort of gut involved. You know, my ranking is, of course, just X vibes, guys. And my internal image of Rodon is more of that. No, I'm just going to go 6 innings, guys, and go like maybe it's 2-3 earned runs. Sure, I'm going to have a bad game or so. But you kind of know that I'm not going to walk the farm. You know that I'm going to go that 6 innings. I'm going to get my strikeout an inning in there. Maybe have some really peak ones. But I'm generally going to be not dropped, and you know that you're going to get relatively this kind of production. While when I think of more cherry bomb types, it's, hey, you're going to walk like 4 or 5 guys today, and it's going to be like a 4-inning game.
Yeah, To me, it's almost a seasonal cherry bomb.
Like, yeah, right. Remember when you heckled at me that Jose Berríos isn't a cherry bomb? Oh, sorry, isn't a Toby? Remember when you heckled me that Jose Berríos isn't a Toby? It was that same idea.
Now he is. He's lost.
I'm just messing around. I'm not saying you were wrong. I just remember that. It was funny.
No, but also the it's more season to season. Like if he shows up next year and he's just healthy all year, I could see him having one of his best seasons ever.
Right.
Bunch of wins for the Yankees. Maybe.
Well, that's the thing too, is that I'm not going to run away from the fact of if you draft Rodon next year, you're not going to drop him. And you're likely to get double digit wins more so than others. Right?
Yeah, what if you don't drop him and you start getting that five ERA season, but
right.
You're like, but his stuff plus is still high just around the corner. It's just around
Oh, don't say this to me.
I want to put high variance on him, and I want to put high variance on him in a couple of ways because of that injury, because of the command. And one thing that I have seen, and I don't want to, it's somebody else's work, so that's going to come out, but you know, really good health grades are meaningful, and then anything below really good is kind of we're guessing
noise. Yeah,
and he's not getting a really good health grade for me.
Right.
So he's already in a high variance health outcome area, and I'm gonna give him a little bit of a high variance outcome, like you know, in terms of results outcome, just because I don't believe the command is very good. So with those two things, he's a little bit like a Snell to me, which I find it very hard to rank these guys because the projection that's based on their stuff plus is always going to be amazing. And the Rodon projection was good all year this year. And he came out with a 3.9 in the end, and he was projected for like a 3.3 for most of the year, even when he had like a 4.5 ERA.
Yeah, so, right.
You know, there were probably some stretches where the projections were right. And Snell was the same thing, where it's like because the stuff is there, and Snell got there in the end. But, you know, Snell doesn't always get there in the end, and Rodon doesn't always get there in the end. And it's just hard to know how many innings you're going to get and what it's going to look like. It's one of those guys where I know the projection's going to tell me, put him in your top 25. And my heart's going to be like, you've been burned before.
This is why I ranked, I think my initial February rank for Hunter Green last year was 60. It's the exact thing of just like, I, as a fantasy manager, will not know what to do.
Yeah.
And I don't want to deal with it. It's why Jesus Lizardo's over there now. I just don't know. And yeah, I think I need Jesus to lower Carlos, but I don't think you're wrong here. I think I need to really take into account that Rodon is not always Rodon. And I am putting more faith in that the adaptation increase of the changeup. Mm. He's a lot more comfortable with that. That I have to think goes up next year too, because changeups from lefties are so huge. That said, you're not wrong that you might just be banging your head against the wall, being like, why did I chase Rodon? And I should probably put him in that Zach Eflin, Seth Lugo, Yu Darvish tier for me. And I know I'm so curious where you're going to put Seth Lugo. I'm not going to ask you that now because we've gone so far now, but I will be. Oh, yes.
Well, I did this weird thing where, you know, I had Seth Lugo like 40 going into the season. And I was high on him.
Yeah.
And then everyone started yelling at me.
I yelled at you.
Not putting him higher after that.
Oh.
So I kind of kept him at 40 all year long. So I think you'll probably be around 40.
Well, I mean, it's the Ranger Suarez problem.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I had him at 75 and I kept like inching him up, even though he was had like a 130.
And then by the time you inched him up all the way, he got
right. He was then going down again. And I'm like, why did I do this? This is dumb.
Because you knew someone who'd yell at you in the comments.
I know. It's so, I hate it. Read the notes. All right. We got to run. I can't thank you all enough for joining us live. You can watch all these episodes on YouTube at the Craft Pitching Podcast YouTube channel. Make sure you do that. And we will be back shortly as well. We're also going to be in Arizona in 2 weeks. So Ian, are you going to yell at me about Blake Snell again during that On the Corner podcast? Tradition. Yeah. Oh, I can't wait. We've got,
I can't even keep track of who has been wrong or right or what.
Oh, no. I'm not. I don't know
it's
either.
Just general yelling.
I just remember last year we were debating for like 15 minutes about Blake Snell, and then
and we ended up like
33.
Yeah, you wanted him like 12. You wanted him 15. I wanted him 12.
Like, it was like we were like one, two spots different, and we're like, oh, so we're in the same place here. We get it. We're on the. But yeah, I mean, this year is going to be so fun. So many people are there. If you've never been to First Pitch Arizona, ask either one of us. We'll tell you everything you need to know. But like, just go. It is the best weekend.
And if you're in the Arizona area, that Friday, the Mesa, I think it's the Mesa.
Yeah, the Mesa Sheridan or
no? The there's a game. You can ping me about it. You can find me on my Discord, or there's a Arizona Fall League game that we're all going to be at.
Yeah. Yes. You can also check it out on the Baseball HQ website. They have the full program there, so you can see
circle that Friday.
There's nothing else. Yeah, there's nothing else going on during that one. There's some
Friday day game is like when we're all probably going to go to that game. Yeah.
So we can't wait for that one. But you know, keep going with the Race and Barrels podcast every morning, every weekday morning for the playoffs. You're doing obviously an amazing job there. Thank you so much for coming on. But on behalf of Eno, my name is Nick Pollock, and we'll talk about the craft of pitching with you again next week. Mm-hmm.